Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is another podcast for the Drugs and Recovery podcast series. And today I've got a former colleague with me, Julia Zampini, who's going to talk to us about her work and about this really awesome research that she's doing called People and Dance Floors. So, Julia, can you tell us who you are and give us some background about your research? And just
Thanks, Rachel. Let
everyone know before I carry on is that I'm a PhD researcher with the University of Kent, and that's where I knew Julia from. We were both sort of researchers at the same time for a while. So, Julia, tell us about yourself and about your research.
Hi, Rachel. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I just, as we met at University of Kent, where I also did my PhD. And I'm obviously, hopefully you can tell from my accent, I'm not British. I've come from Italy, but I've been in the UK since 2003. So I came to the UK and it was very much the time of New Labour, called Britannia, all that sort of stuff. And I think I really bought into, when I was young, the idea of globalization and Europe as a positive force. You know, I thought that, I was European, that I wanted to get to know the UK as, I guess, an empire, a successful empire through its American connection and before. And, you know, growing up in Italy, most of the music we consumed, the TV, the products we consumed, everything was American or British. So I think I had that kind of curiosity. Anyway, moved to the UK and ended up sort of staying. And, you know, I did that thing where I tried to go to work, but then I kept coming back to university because I don't know, a lot of the jobs that I was doing were not necessarily fulfilling in the same way. I should say I'm pretty privileged. I'm middle class. And obviously that allowed me to make certain choices in life that maybe I wouldn't have done if it wasn't for having financial support from the parents. But anyway, back to the university stuff. So in between my my degree and my master's, my master's and my PhD? So I started off with history, a history degree and politics. And then I went on to do a master's in sociolegal studies. And then whilst I was doing that, I think I started volunteering for an organization called Transform Drug Policy Foundation, which is an organization that exists since the 1990s, and they campaign for kind of drug policy, responsible drug policy reform in the direction of regulation, responsible regulation of all drugs. And so I started volunteering for them, and I was quite young and quite clueless, and I felt like I was learning a lot just by listening to them. But after that, I was like, okay, so this is what you're saying, and I get your point, I get your argument. You know, they were talking about the effects of drug policy on poor people, on developing countries. I think the argument made sense, but I wanted to see, how drugs affected people in different ways. This coming from somebody who, again, is middle class, has lots of experience with drugs recreationally, smokes. So I'm not a stranger to drug. I'm just, maybe I never had a problematic relationship with any drugs apart from cigarettes. So that was my thing. And anyway, I went to volunteer for a harm reduction service in Bristol. Mm-hmm. And I got into, and that's when around the time where there was a shift really in UK drug policy from harm reduction, away from harm reduction and towards a more recovery oriented agenda. So it was very much like we need to embed recovery into our services. And, we need to demonstrate that people are recovering. We can't just keep people, on treatment forever. And that very much came as a political push from the government at the time. So that's how I got into drug policy research. Round about that time, I think I saw there was an advert for a PhD scholarship, which was set out to look at the use of evidence in drug policy. So it was set out as an already themed PhD, and I applied, and I basically wrote a proposal based on that, and that's how I got to Kent. so that's, and then obviously I met you some years later, but Yeah, and so I set out to look at the use of evidence in policy, I would say the use, but also understandings of evidence in policy. And I was comparing drug policy with sex work prostitution policy in the UK and Australia, or I should say in England and New South Wales in Australia. So
the policy, so the evidence related to policy, I would imagine tends to focus on the sort of more problematic drug use, in the same way that the legislation about sex work tends to focus on the most marginalized, or, you know, the people for whom things have gone wrong. It never really looks at people who have a happy relationship with drugs, or, you know, or quite happy, sort of like engaged in successful and non-damaging sex work.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think, you know, that was a part of my reasoning, I think, behind the People and Dance Floors project, trying to make some space for more positive narratives around the relationship between people and drugs. I think if things are problematic, they don't get talked about in the same way. And of course, there's a dual thing of it's not just that it's not problematic, but it's also that the activity is stigmatized. So people don't talk about it because it's stigmatized, and therefore they don't necessarily want to, come out and as drug users or as sex workers, and maybe taint their reputation as a result. Yeah. So that's one part of it. And of course, the other part of it is that often policy is made and addresses people, the most problematic of drug users or for example, street sex workers who also have a relationship with drugs or use drugs. So as a result of that, really a policy should be made, as a universal thing to suit the needs of, of people in general. But unfortunately, that's not possible. It's a blunt instrument. Yeah. Policy is a blunt instrument. Law is a blunt instrument. So it doesn't respond to a variety, a diversity of needs and desires, I guess.
Yeah. No, it tends to focus on the worst case scenario, doesn't it? And almost, use that as a norm. Mm. Yeah, so it takes the most extreme example of something and then uses that as a basis for legislation. So can you tell us a little bit about the People in Dance Floor project? How did that come about?
So basically what happened was that, I guess, as a result of my interest in the relationship between evidence and policy, and how evidence was understood but also communicated, I think I started to kind of become a bit frustrated by the fact that there appeared to be a kind of lack of communication or lack of understanding between different stakeholders in the kind of policy debate and in the policy domain in the context of drugs specifically. So there would be a lot of discussions between kind of expert high-level stakeholders who use the particular language to communicate, but none of that was necessarily intelligible or accessible to the general public. So, there's discussions about harm reduction that go on, really useful and kind of expert discussions and evidence that is exchanged, but doesn't necessarily trickle down to people from outside that sort of drug policy bubble. So in part, the People and Dance First project came about in order to kind of bypass the academic language and to make people's narratives accessible for all to have an emotional connection with. So the project uses film precisely for that purpose. I didn't want to be an academic that translated discussed other people's narratives and became like a proxy for other people's narratives. I wanted for those narratives to be accessible to all, and for people to, to take center stage and to discuss their experiences without my mediation. So I think that was, in part what, the kind of ethos that I wanted to pursue with the project. And I should say, it's not just me, it's we're a collective of people. So obviously the participants are a massive part of the project. They're sort of front and center, and without them, there wouldn't be a project. And also I've worked with an activist out of Bristol called Dan. I worked with a filmmaker. So it's really a kind of labor of love and a partnership with lots of different people. And more recently, other researchers have also joined the project. And we envisioned this as a network. So we want it to be inclusive. We wanted to expand. We want to for people to be able to use this as an umbrella or as a kind of home for them to be able to develop their own kind of ideas that maybe fall within within the broad umbrella of people, dance floors, and the relationship between people, dance floors, and drugs.
Yeah.
So yeah.
And for anyone listening in, the format of the project is there's is it a 20-minute film?
I think. Yeah.
Created. There's also an academic journal, which you both of which you can link to from the blog that's attached to this. There's also you also blog on your website as well. It's a kind of multi-faceted research that's really accessible. It's not hidden behind like a university paywall, which is so often the case. And I really enjoyed it. So can you tell us about the research methodology that you used?
Yeah. So I'm a qualitative researcher. I just love to talk and I love to listen. So that's mainly what I do. And what I, you know, in the past, that was that, you know, the main method that I had adopted was interviews. So obviously, having no experience in kind of multimedia engagement or filmmaking, I sort of approached other people who did have experience. And I was like, how about doing a kind of qualitative interview-based project, but that uses film? So effectively, I mean, for me, the film itself is a collection of interviews that is analyzed through thematic analysis. So the same way that I would approach any interview data or transcript, but done collaboratively. So we started off conscious of the fact that not everybody might want to speak about their drug use on camera, because obviously, you know, some people might be comfortable with it, some people might not. So we offered people the opportunity to also do audio interviews, where their voice would be distorted so that they wouldn't be recognizable, as well as contributing through like written statements and more creative artifacts like photography or poetry or, you know, things like that. So we left it really open for people to make a contribution in whatever way they wanted to. And so we ended up with like a few written statements, a few audio interviews, and a few on camera in face-to-face interviews. And then we sort of tried to edit it all together into sort of some sort of narrative that followed the stories of different participants through a thread and identified the main themes, which obviously were in part were sort of led by the questions. The questions were about, you know, we asked people, what do dance floors mean to you? What do drugs mean to you? And, you know, how did the two things come together in your life? And then we asked people, you know, whether they were comfortable to talk to other people about their drug use, particularly parents, family, work colleagues, just to see, you know, to tackle that kind of taboo or drugs as a taboo subject. And yeah, it's incredible the stuff that people came up with. But I should say in the film, there's also a little bit of an attack on alcohol. But that wasn't from the question. That was purely from people's own kind of frustrations about the differences in which the UK culture particularly approaches alcohol as a drug compared to other drugs. So I guess the hypocrisy that lies beneath that.
Yeah.
So that was a theme as well.
I mean, there were so many themes in this film that even just watching it was kind of like you could like really pick up themes, because there was obviously kind of like a demographic, you know, we were talking like, I think between 30, the people speaking were between 30 and 40. I think they were exclusively white, but the way that they were talking about the dance floor and the drug use associated with the dance floor was so It was kind of like, it was almost like they're talking about it like a rite of passage. They're talking about a time that had been really significant to them when they'd sort of like started to really kind of embrace life outside of their bedroom, basically. It's like, you know, with a couple of the people talking, I got the impression that they bounced straight from their bedroom onto the dance floor and how significant that had been. But also that it wasn't, although they were sort of reminiscing, it's not historic. So the tension around that, the kind of like dance floor drugs may have like shifted somewhat, but that actually that life is still carrying on.
Yeah, I mean, I should say about the demographic that we, because we had to turn the project around very quickly because we were on a tight schedule. So we just went through our existing networks. So yes. Obviously the people that we ended up interviewing were very much people in our networks, obviously similar age to us, similar, you know, I guess, yeah, more or less similar background to us. So it's very samey in that respect. But you are right. It's not, you know, people are reminiscing, and that's very much in line with what a lot of the research on kind of club and leisure studies says about you know, kind of youth into adulthood transitions, and you know, the kind of ritualistic participation in clubs or on dance floors as something of a rite of passage, but as something very, very significant in people's lives, and something that stays, if not through practice, meaning if not through people continuing to engage with the dance floors in their like in the later years, at least through I think a kind of like a sense, an emotion, a continued way of connecting with people, and perhaps also a socializing and a continued role of drugs in their lives, even if it becomes more sporadic.
Yeah. But also as well, it was like there was an element of protest around the dancing and the drug use that I think really was really highlighted really well in the discussions that people were having, because, you know, I think it's at the 1983 Criminal Justice Act, or lack of criminal justice, yeah, that sort of like saw this sort of like closing down of the, you know, sort of raves and things like that. And there was a kind of a sense of people reminiscing about a time past when actually there was a lot more freedom than there is now. And actually there was an alternative narrative around drug use.
Yeah, it's interesting that it's almost like cyclical in a way. Like, you know, you had a lot of people are kind of making comparisons between the criminal justice, the 1994, I think it's called Criminal Justice Bill, or was it Crime and Criminal Justice or Crime and Policing? I can't remember exactly. Apologize. But 1994 and what's happening today with the new bill and the protests that are, you know, are happening at the moment, the Kill the Bill protests. And, you know, there is a sense of, you know, again, that this kind of cyclical thing. And I think it's a strange one. I think people, you know, find they still find freedom within those environments, because they will come to that environment, the club environment or the rave environment, and they will feel like immediately once they kind of, you know, once they pass the threshold, you know, they know that they're with like-minded people. They know that a lot of the people in there are there to like release and let go and to kind of feel as one and to belong, right? And so it's almost like this kind of temporary autonomous zone or this kind of like environment that is separate. And then the moment they come out, you know, and they kind of go back to their day to day, hopefully they're able to keep the feeling of the experience with them, but they can't, you know, they can't speak about it free. They can't necessarily bring, you know, that whole freedom or sense of freedom and joy and connection. Like, people behave differently when they're at the office or when they're, you know, talking to strangers in the club environment compared to, you know, a more kind of routine environment.
Yeah.
And I think that's somehow, in some way, it's a shame. And in some way, it's like, it's almost, you know, I feel like sometimes people are holding back from really connecting to others. Maybe sometimes because they're inhibited, they're afraid, or they, you know, they don't necessarily want to, you know, come out and look like idiots. Whereas I think when people are on drugs, especially, you know, MDMA, for example, they just don't care about what they're going to be perceived like, how they're going to be perceived by others as much. You know, they just, they if they feel like saying to somebody, I love you, even though they don't know them, they will say it. They might hug strangers and so on.
And this is what we lose when we look at anything just purely through a criminal lens. I mean, it happens with sex work. I think Laura Augustine has said that actually we look at sex work just as a problem rather than looking at it as a really rich, like, sort of cultural studies exercise. And it's the same with drugs, isn't it? I mean, you know, how much harm is done to society because of this narrative of only looking at drugs as harmful? I mean, you know, I'm a recovered addict. But the issue was never drugs. The issue was like my unresolved trauma. And what drugs allowed me to do, and I think what drugs can do, is it allows you to step out of your day-to-day living, you know? And that is what I really kind of got from the film, is that people were reminiscing about the ability to step out of life and then step back in again. And it was really kind of evocative for me. It made me, you know, I used to go to the Ministry of Sound when it first opened, and, like, you know, the whole time, and I would be in there for days, like, literally. And it would be one experience totally when you were inside the club, and then you came out and it was like, oh, okay, I'm back in South London, whereas before, where I felt like I'd escaped to my tribe, you know, I'd been able to step out of my current existence and step into something else where I was able to communicate with people on a different level. And I think that space is really, really important. And I think the legislation around drugs takes that space away. Mm. We're actually deprived under this guise of protecting us. What we're actually deprived of is a space where we can communicate with each other and just, you know, and not, you know, sort of like be at one for a little while.
Mm, exactly. I mean, it's, you know, you're completely right in saying that the deprivation of the space and the time and the ability to connect with others is massively problematic for people. Is harmful in itself. So it's problematic, I think, for people's mental health and physical health. So if people are not provided, so, you know, I get really annoyed about people's inability to hold both harm and pleasure, or harm, you know, or positive and negative, as something that can both be a result of, say, drug taking in the context of dance floors. Is like, yeah, there is an element, there's a harmful element, there's also a pleasure element, there is also a well-being element, and all of these things coexist together in the space and in the activity. So it's not just one or the other. Yeah. And you know, and it's very difficult somehow for people to hold that idea, and also for policy and legislation to reflect that. Yeah. But we're able to do it in the context of medicines. And when, you know, when doctors prescribe a drug, they will say, you know, this has side effects, you know, this might make you feel dizzy, or it might make you vomit, but at the same time, it might cure you from your illness, or it might save your life. So we're able to do that in the context of medicine. And we know that drugs are technologies that can do lots of different things. And that they are not in and of themselves either good or bad. They're just, you know, technologies, and they're, you know, things that can do different things, both harmful and pleasant, and life saving and potentially deadly. So yeah, it's just sort of, is that ability to think of, you know, any substance like that, and so as a, you know, and then after that, maybe to have a less, I don't know, kind of a less black and white understanding or vision about what you know, what kind of clubs are for and what they do. Because I think especially now, especially today, we have this, I don't know, I think it maybe it's because of the people we're being governed by in the UK. There's very much this kind of division between, like, you know, good and bad. This is like the good culture is like, yeah, you know, the BBC and the ballet and just, you know, just the stuff that maybe a particular demographic and a particular class would engage in. But anything else is just seen as, like, I don't know, dangerous or a threat, or not worth investing in, even though it's, you know, there is a thriving economy around, you know, electronic dance music, for example, but it's not necessarily seen as something that is worth, that is part of good culture.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was quite struck when I was looking at your website as well, when you talk about, you know, sort of like how the policing of some of these dance halls is so is so dangerous, you know, like the policing around like sort of grime acts and stuff like that. I don't know if anyone's familiar with this, but grime, you know, this sort of like, you know, largely black urban sort of music movement experiences a lot of racist policing. You know, like a sort of community that comes under siege, is constantly under siege, is policed through the back door. And I was quite struck as well when people were talking, because they were obviously making the comparison between sort of drugs and the harms of alcohol. But I was just thinking about the policing of drugs and how much more damaging that is than the actual drugs themselves. I mean, because, you know, some of the drugs that are policed, they've got like this long history of, you know, being really beneficial. I mean, let's not even get into the debate about marijuana and the fact that it gets like criminalized because the plantocracy in the Deep South has lost its slave labor force. And now what they do is they try to legislate its main competitor, hemp, you know. But yeah, you know, it was really nice to see these middle class people who were, they were doctors and things like that, actually talking about drugs in a positive way. You know, because actually we need that narrative to balance, don't we?
I mean, let's be honest as well. Middle class people are more likely to have a positive experience with drugs than working class people. Yeah. You know, in the main, obviously, because they're obviously, of course, middle class people or upper class people can carry trauma, which may lead them to having or developing a really negative relationship with some drugs. But I think in the main, middle class people are less likely to be harassed because of their drug use. They're, you know, or policed as well. They're more likely to be able to afford buying drugs and therefore, you know, not get into debt or not commit any crime in order to acquire them. You know, and of course it's intersectionality and people's relationship with drug use massively shapes trajectories or journeys, and that's kind of the point that we tried to make with the paper that we wrote. You know, reflecting on our own positionality, it was like, you know, each of our experiences of the people in Dance First team research team, very different depending on our class of origin, depending on our individual experiences with drugs and so on. But then, you know, at the same time, you know, it's important, I think, for people with privilege to talk about drugs and to talk about their relationship with drugs, whether positive or negative. It's important for people to not hide, because if they continue hiding, you know, I'm in agreement with Carl Hart on this. If people continue hiding, they will just perpetuate the same narratives, the same stigma, and they will perpetuate the same stereotypical images of who drug users are, what they do, and so on. Yeah. And I just think those images are just, they're damaging primarily to the people who have the most problematic relationship with drugs. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and then for anyone who's listening and doesn't know who Carl Hart is, I can't remember which university he's attached to, but
I think it's Columbia. Yeah, Columbia.
I think he's one of the few black tenured professors in the States, isn't he? And he writes a lot about, you know, sort of like the actual kind of like the physical effects of drugs and how the majority of people who take drugs, even drugs like heroin, which he also claims to have taken, which was quite brave of him to say, because it's one thing to say, yeah, I have a couple of spliffs, but to come out and say that you've taken heroin is quite a brave thing for an academic to do. And he talks about, you know, that the majority of people do not have problematic relationships with drugs, and that the people that do, it's because there's other parts of their life that's problematic. The drugs aren't the issue. The pre-existing trauma is the issue. And so he's, you know, his viewpoint is, you know, it's been really, you know, sort of is really important. But again, it gets hidden behind the paywalls of universities and, you know, it doesn't really get discussed very much, which is why this type of research is really important, I believe, because it allows people who don't have access to journals to actually, you know, sort of tune into the debate of what's going on.
I mean, I feel like now things are improving. There's, you know, there is, I think, a willingness and a need and a commitment by a lot of people in academia to try to, in academia and beyond, not just in academia, to try to like find different ways of communicating. And I think, you know, I guess COVID also has been like probably a year in which podcasts have boomed and people have tried to maintain connections somehow despite the enforced physical distance. So I hope that, you know, and I was talking about this with some other colleagues, and I hope to see more people sort of take to, you know, take to their social media or any medium that they're able to use, that they're well versed in, to just communicate with one another without, you know, at the same time without sort of, you know, without alienating others. Because alienation is never a good thing, whether you're alienating people, you know, by nature of like, you know, being in silos or small offices and not communicating, or whether you're alienating people through maybe language that people can't understand or access.
Yeah, we definitely need to address the language. But also as well, I think academia needs to start becoming more reflective about its unwillingness to talk about drug taking. But we're academics, and you know, it seems to me that the alcoholism is endemic to academia,
you know? Oh my god, alcohol is endemic to most social situations, and particularly in Anglophone culture, because I find this, you know, compared to the country that I'm from, where I think, you know, there's definitely been an upward trend with alcohol and young people. Like young people are definitely drinking more and find more occasions to drink, and drinking differently compared to their parents' generation. But still, like, you know, the way in which, like, the level at which alcohol is embedded in every social situation in the UK is incredible. Like, for me, I could, you know, often I can't believe it. I can't believe how much people drink. It's so funny. It's just like, you're having another one? What? So, yeah. And also, like people are saying in the film, you know, when you say you don't want to drink, people are like, are you sure, babe? Are you all right? Like, I'm like, yeah, I'm just not fancy a drink right now.
I have this all the time. But it really kind of made me think as well that actually, you know, that kind of like, you know, I was discussing this with you the other day about semiology and the social harms that are done through legislation and stuff like that, and the kind of hidden social harms that we don't realize that we're experiencing when activities they're not inherently damaging in themselves, are sort of prohibited to us. I think, you know, I think that society loses a lot when we are not able to have those kind of bonding experiences that you can often have in terms of dancing and in terms of drugs, except in, you know, sort of like places where it's deemed suitable. So I'm thinking, you know, sort of dance floors are sort of like increasingly sort of policed, but sort of festivals, okay, that's okay. Everything gets suspended for a festival with a, you know, a massive kind of corporate interest, you know, and, you know, that kind of negotiation that goes on around drugs and when drugs can be used.
Yeah, you know? I think in terms of harm, I think a lot of the harm that people experience, say people who are not criminalized for their drug use. Yeah. I think they experience harm because they are they're internalizing stigma. So they are then, you know, living through this kind of stigma, and they're feeling guilty, they're feeling ashamed, and all that kind of guilt and shame, I think eventually plays on people's well-being. It plays on their psyche, it plays on their, and so that kind of prevents, I think, people from, you know, from being, you know, fully realized and healthy, because, you know, maybe they're thinking about, oh, I should have done that, or I'm a terrible person, I'm a failure, I'm a bad person, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's partly harmful. And of course, you know, in the festival environment and in a club environment, you know, with the policing or the kind of control, you know, people may end up, you know, doing drugs in really unsafe ways as well. So they may end up like, you know, doing them in like really dirty environments or in toilets. They may end up like taking more than they meant to because, you know, they're just not, you know, they're rushed, they're being rushed in or out. Yeah, I mean, they will go unsupervised. Of course, you know, they will take drugs that they haven't tested, so they don't know what how potent they are or whether they even what it says on the tin. So yeah, there's a lot of issues around the consequences of prohibition and kind of policing of certain substances. So it's difficult. It's difficult.
But I suppose as well, what sort of like wasn't really touched on in this you know, this particular debate, but which I've heard you talk about with your other work, is the harms that the increased harms that are done to people in an attempt to save them from other types of drugs. And I watched a TED talk that you did a couple of years ago, and you made this point, and it really resonated with me because I'm aware of this as well. The dangers of, say, methadone, you know, and how much more damaging that is for people than, say, heroin is. I mean, you know, this isn't an advert for heroin, but, you know, sort of methadone is very hard to withdraw from and has that really, really negative physical effects in ways that people don't necessarily sort of think about, you know, like, for example, it has really bad effects on your teeth and your bones and stuff like that. And, you know, and I just think sort of sometimes this kind of nanny state suffocates to protect, and that this sense was really coming through in your video. That
I mean, it makes absolutely no sense. Like, you know, people like that input, like the international network of people who use drugs and like other drug user activists have been saying for ages, and there is solid evidence from Professor, I think it was Professor John Strang at London School of Hygiene, who did a study on this, you know, ages ago, which said that, you know, you ought to give people diamorphine. That's a better script than methadone will ever be. And I mean, I'm not saying that methadone doesn't work for some people, but obviously with methadone, you can use heroin on top, so you can potentially be on a script and then go out and still, you know, acquire heroin off the street and then use on top. And you know, literally every single person who has been given a diamorphine script as kind of demonstrated that the quality of life is much better than somebody that is on a methadone script.
Yeah.
So, you know, why give methadone? I don't know. Like, it's a hangover from the 70s. It's cheaper, maybe. I don't know. Like, it makes absolutely no sense. But, you know, it tends to be the most popular, you know, in opiate substitution treatment, it tends to be the most popular option. And again, I'm not saying it doesn't work for some people, but you know, it shouldn't be the main option. I mean, obviously there is Suboxone and, you know, buprenorphine and stuff that also seems to work for other people, and it seems to be better overall in terms of health, you know, of health impact in the kind of medium term and long term. But yeah, it's beyond me.
It's frustrating. So how do you see the rave scene coming back after COVID? How badly has it been affected by COVID? I mean, what's going on out there now?
it's I mean, so basically there was a lot of raves were happening at the start, especially after the relaxation of the first lockdown last summer. There was a sense also that you know, local communities were both, I think, upset by it, but also some of them were quite sympathetic.
Yeah.
Also because a lot of the raves were being organized by like young people who, you know, I guess essentially felt like they had nothing to lose and nowhere else to go and be, and they'd rather have a get together. I think somebody who wrote a Vice article did a bit of research saying that there was three types of raves. One was the type of rave where the organizers just wanted to like make loads of money from people. So they didn't care about the kind of conditions of the place. Maybe it would be indoors. It wouldn't be COVID safe in the slightest. And then there would be like other kind of, you know, kind of hush hush raves for more experienced and a kind of an older, kind of more seasoned crowd. Which would be, you know, which you wouldn't know about, and it would be very much like in the, you know, in the network, in the group. And then, yeah, the more sort of like DIY young people's cruise.
Yeah.
And so that was going on in the summer. The problem, you know, that it was the policing. The policing became more intense. And they, you know, there was an emergency legislation whereby they would charge £10,000. As a penalty for rave organizers, and I think something like £100 or £200 to punters.
Right.
So obviously that put a lot of people off. Well, it put some people off, especially the people who don't have any money. So you know, your young DIY type crews wouldn't be able to afford such a steep penalty. And I think some still went ahead because they've got that kind of protest mentality, and they, you know, they're like, fuck the police type approach. But yeah, I think for the most part, there was less and less raves, you know, over the second lockdown.
Yeah.
But I think there's going to be an emergence of illegal raves again in the summer. But, you know, this is on the backdrop is the new bill, which is very much, it's so, you know, it's basically like the 94 bill, which was basically about criminalizing raves. It was like, you know, and any gathering of more than 10 people where a repetitive beat is heard is undesirable. And, you know, I don't remember the exact wording, but it was very much about.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I mean, also as well, I mean, I suppose the sort of like lockdown has been like a real reset about how we socialize as well, isn't it? Because I will not mention the name of the town that I live in, but I live in a very funky seaside town. And basically, like all through lockdown, the beaches have just been hopping, you know, like, you know, sort of like, you know, sort of sensibly distanced bonfires, and people will be out there all night. And it's kind of, I don't know, I think COVID has almost reset the way that we party. But what really struck me when I was listening to and watching your podcast and listening to the film is how much we desperately need a sort of ultra realist approach to drag ethnographies. I mean, you know, I'm the daughter of like young women, yeah, who are in their 20s now, but there was a period of time before COVID when I was picking up people every weekend from lay-bys, you know, like literally my children would emerge from a wood, yeah, and they're having a real experience. But you know, we're not kind of really, that's not really coming through in the data or the research, and we need that. We need to kind of go back to basics, don't we? Just really get out there and do some research.
I think so. I think we're hopefully, if all goes well, we're planning to also do some research in Malta to try to kind of get a sense for how, you know, similar or different the narratives of people are in the Maltese context. But I just think you're right. It's like, so that there is something about a kind of spontaneous DIY rave, which is an intimate affair, let's say, that is often a rite of passage for a lot of young people, at least in the UK, you know, and by young, I mean pre, you know, in their teens, you know, like 15, 16, 17, you know, before they can go out and drink legally and go to clubs and whatnot. And I just think that that sort of, you know, that kind of rite of passage for many people it's a magical thing, because it's where they first, you know, come out of their bedroom and they learn how to sort of relate with others, and they learn how to be in a space with other people, but also to take the space, a space that is public, to have fun, to experience pleasure. And that's really important as an education, I think, because, you know, then you go out and every other space is privatized. You have to consume, you know, you have to kind of pay to get in. You have to consume a substance that you pay for. You know, everything is quite, you know, and you have to have money in order to go out. It's not a cheap affair. So, yeah, I don't know. I think it's important that people, you know, have that experience. It's important that those experiences are understood. Also, for in a more romantic way as well, in a more kind of,
yeah. I hear you. So, how did you feel about bringing your sort of like academic persona into your private life? Because you've basically laid yourself bare, haven't you? You know, and to an extent, the people in the films. How did that feel? Did that feel kind of risky to do that?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, at first, the reason why I'm not in the film to, as a participant, because at first I was like, maybe I should, do the double thing of like being, I'm the person who interviews, but I'm also a participant. The reason why I didn't do that is because the film was actually funded by the University of Greenwich, which is where I work. So I was like, maybe I shouldn't do that for this film. Maybe the next film when I get external, I had some internal dialogue, and also I talked to the other project partners about what they thought about me being in the film and not being in the film. But yeah, eventually I just thought it wasn't ethically like for my personal ethics, for my own feminist ethics, it wouldn't be okay to put the camera onto these people and ask them to lay themselves bare without also doing the same myself. So and I think in a way, the personal experience was what pushed me towards doing a project that was about people and dance first. Because I was the young raver at 17. I was the recreational drug user. So I wanted for that to be, I wanted for something that I understood intimately to be something that I also I looked at academically, because it to me again as a feminist researcher, it just makes sense. It's obvious. It's not even, yeah, it's a no-brainer,
Yeah.
basically.
I mean, like in my own experience recently, where I've spent the last couple of years interviewing sort of like street level sex workers, the vast majority of whom are like addicted, are addicts because, just the level of trauma that they would be in. And I would interview people, and it's like that, it's that awareness of drugs and that kind of openness about drugs allows you to interview people that wouldn't necessarily relate to you, but also as well, you have a knowledge around drugs that makes it important in an interview situation. So if you've got an addict, you can't really interview them what they need to use, but then there's a time period after they've used where they're just gouging out, they're no good for anything, they can't talk. So it's like, what do you do with someone like that? Okay, you give them sort of a sugary drink. The sugary drink will bring them straight round. So you get that window of opportunity between need and having satisfied that need when they're actually able to give informed consent and you can interview them. But there's this kind of like there's a sort of like a sort of double standard with the universities whereas they want us to study these interesting and research attracting areas, but at a remove. I can talk about my drug use because it's at a distance, and I don't use drugs anymore, so it looks like I've reformed. So I'm allowed to talk about it, but if I was still using, it wouldn't be, you wouldn't be able to talk about it. So it kind of maintains this empirical distance from between research and the people that we're trying to research, which is why I really enjoyed what you did, because it's a kind of like trying to get past the universities as we always do.
Yeah, it's definitely a hangover from when people thought that research was objective and the knowledge had to be produced in order to be objective and the ultimate truth. And it was very masculinist, detached, idea about what knowledge was and what it was for. I think, and I'm not saying that people who don't have experience with drugs or sex work that they can't do research on it, but I feel like, that there needs to be alliances and partnerships in knowledge, which bring together people with different backgrounds and different skills and different interests to be able to talk to each other about, and I think, to produce better knowledge effectively, you're not going to do it on your own, because you're mind, your brain is limited, your mind is limited, your experience is limited, and your experience necessarily impacts the kind of your horizon, your view, your perspective, the kind of things that you understand and not and can and cannot say. So I just think that, if we accept that everyone's perspective is necessarily limited by design, then we can then kind of move on to talk about, how do we create, more useful knowledge that is, more representative of like a diversity of experiences that is inclusive and so on and so forth. So yeah, and so starting from personally, like starting from my or trying to marry my personal experience and interests with academic research is a good starting point to feel like, you know, or to be able to build from. Yeah, I think that's definitely something that I hope will mean that ultimately I can generate, you know, more humble, but also more informed and interesting stuff compared to, you know, pretending like I was a detached scholar, you know, looking at things from the outside and kind of making a neutral assessment.
Yeah, I think it's important as well, like, and you touch on this in this work, but I've heard you talk about this before when we talk about whose knowledge is heard. And I think we have to be conscious that, you know, as researchers under the shadow of the university, that our voice can drown out, you know, lived knowledge, you know, maybe deeper knowledge. And that, you know, the fact that you want to study something, if you do not have personal experience of that, you know, there needs to be some kind of self-reflection. If I don't have personal knowledge of this and I have to find ways into this community, should I be the person who's studying this?
Yeah, I think that there's been a, most recently, I think there's been a political shift, a paradigm shift around this, whereby people used to be happy to be research participants and to be kind of to enter into a hierarchical or asymmetric relationship with the researcher, where the researcher was the knowledge bearer and they would extract information from the participant and then they would, you know, kind of interpret it and then put it out there as theirs, as their own, right? And I think, you know, that's, all of that is changing. You know, we're entering into like a different paradigm. It's more individualistic, it's more person-centered. And the whole, you know, discussion about intersectionality, positionality, you know, all of that is decentering power and centering individual experiences as the main source. So as a result of that, I think that, you know, research has got to, like, research in academia has to change. It has to respond to this.
Yeah.
And I think the way I see it, the best way to do it is to enter into partnerships, knowledge partnerships with people, where people have a stake, and not just a stake, but where people are also recognized for the contribution that they make. And for the knowledge that they bring, you know, not as like, you know, I'm going to extract knowledge from you and I'm going to pluck it into the project and pretend like it comes from my brain, but as like, you know, we're entering into this partnership and then you have a stake and then you make decisions and we make decisions together and I contribute and you contribute. And I like that kind of complementarity idea.
Yeah, sort of participatory activist research. But even that is still problematic, isn't it? Because, you know, if we're the people bringing the money to the research, you know, and ultimately we are the people that maybe sort of transcribe the research, that interpret the research, there's still a power sort of dynamic that's difficult to negotiate. I mean, I've been exploring sort of ideas around sort of ultra-realism, where, you know, basically we're abandoning everything that we think we know and just send people out on to go and carry out ethnographies that aren't actually looking to answer questions. Because quite often this is the issue, isn't it? Is that we set up a question based on what we think we know, you know, and, you know, maybe sometimes what we need to do is just having people that are just able to immerse themselves in the communities where they belong to in order to sort of generate research.
I mean, absolutely. I think that, you know, obviously there's a different, like, so to me, doing an ethnography is like a dream, right? It's like I wish that I, you know, that I could have the time and the money and the investment to be able to just be like, okay, I'm university, you know, give me some funding and give me a sabbatical and I'm just going to go away and immerse myself and then write. And then, you know, have, because I think an ethnography is a beautiful concept, but it's a very time-consuming and emotionally involving process, which the neoliberal university doesn't necessarily account for in its way of working, in its way of like saying, you know, you get the funding in November, money has to be spent by July. And, you know, it's very, you know, you need to answer questions that are useful. You need to demonstrate impact. You need to have X number of publications by, you know. So essentially you're talking about the principles of what knowledge generation and research should be and what it should be for versus what the neoliberal university and what the REF strategy and what the kind of higher education policy has as a whole thinks research should be about. It should be about, you know, addressing hard questions, you know, like, I don't know how much, what percentage of overall funding in the UK was COVID related in the past year. But like, you know, all of a sudden, I mean, I understand that we have to respond to COVID as, you know, as a problem that affected us all and that we needed to understand it and so on. But from that to saying that, you know, basically there was no funding unless you had a COVID thing in, you know what I mean? It's limiting. It's limiting.
Yeah. But also as well, I think as researchers, we it's almost like, you know, you get into the university system or the research system and actually what you realize is that it's not working with you. It wants statistics. It wants numbers it can crunch. And, you know, that somehow as researchers, we have to negotiate our way around this kind of quants hungry sort of system that we find ourselves in. And actually what I found is that actually you can do ethnography in a kind of like a down low way when you're doing other types of research. So, you know, I was involved with this quants research for the London School of Hygiene, but the majority of the research went on in the time that we were looking for people to interview before and after the interview, when we were buying them at McDonald's. That's when the majority of the ethnographic stuff really went on, you know? So it's almost like you have to kind of snatch ethnography from the jaws of this quants monster that now owns the university. But, you know, researchers, there are ways, you know, we can do this. We just have to be creative.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. I'm being pessimistic there. I think I'm still struggling myself to find a like a working compromise between the neoliberal university's demands and my own, I think my own principles and ethos and desires as a researcher. Yeah. And I think, you know, I'm still quite young and inexperienced. So hopefully through practice and perseverance, I'll get to understand it a bit better and maybe like, you know, let's say play the system to my own advantage. Yeah.
So have you got ways, are you sort of like, have you got new research kind of formula, and have you got other ways that you can, you know, like we've mentioned that this film has been a really good way for you to get people's voices out. So have you got any other sort of like ideas of how we can make people's voices more visible in the debate about drug taking?
Yeah, so what I'd like to do next, what we'd like to do now, we've been talking about, is to kind of widen out the scope of the discussion to involve, to bring together kind of nighttime economy stakeholders. And I mean that in the kind of broadest possible sense. So it could be promoters, DJs, people who, you know, will kind of use nighttime spaces, but also are part of the nighttime economy, bouncers, you know, anybody who's involved, and also punters and drug users, and sort of have a much broader kind of set of views and perspectives about, you know, how they, how they live through the nighttime economy. Mm-hmm. And I think the pandemic has given us this unprecedented opportunity to take stock and think about the future. And so I'm thinking about the future. In thinking about the future, I want to get a variety of different perspectives about what does the ideal utopian future look like for you. And I think I'd like to, look at the intersection between drugs, well-being, change, and harm reduction. Harm reduction, kind of understood in the widest possible sense.
Yeah.
So harm reduction as maybe a principle that informs everything that goes on in that environment, from relations of from non-exploitative relations to mental well-being to harm reduction in a traditional sense around drugs and drug testing and that sort of stuff. You know, all of that, you know, I want to try to sort of weave that together to see what happens. So just, yeah, widening out the scope, still thinking maybe about drug policy reform, but thinking about all the other stakeholders involved and asking them what they think about the future.
Yeah, it just occurs to me as well. We never ask the really elderly about their drug use, do we? You know, like that kind of lifetime of drug use, a successful drug use, i.e. you're still alive, you're healthy. What better evidence of your successful drug use?
That would be amazing.
I mean, you know, because there's so many sort of like, you know, like considering sort of drugs are kind of like liminal, drug taking is liminal, it occupies liminal spaces. There's a lot of stuff that we assume that we leave outside. So, you know, but class plays a massive part in the debate around drugs. But then so does age and so does poverty. And, you know, it always opens more doors than it answers. And that's what I really liked about your research, is that it really got me thinking.
Yeah, I mean, there's loads more to be done. Like, there's loads more into, even if we wanted to kind of, you know, run the same thing again, but then widen it out to a much bigger demographic in terms of age, in terms of like ethnic background and experiences and all that. Like, you know, there's loads there, you know, that needs to be done. And you are right. Like, older people who've had a successful drug using career, you know, we don't know who they are. We don't know about that. They don't necessarily. Well, you know. Maybe they come out and they say, oh, yeah, I was foolish in my youth, but now I'm reformed. Or they kind of joke about it, but it's never something that is kind of seriously acknowledged or addressed. Even by artists and people in the, you know, people who have who are in the kind of entertainment industry, who I think tend to be, you know, the perfect candidate for that sort of, or assuming that they're the perfect ones for that sort of lifestyle.
I was just thinking about the last time I saw my auntie, who's in her late 60s. And like, when I came round, she got me to roll all her spliffs for her because she can't do it, because she's got arthritis. She got me to roll up all her spliffs. And then called a friend round for me to do hers as well, because like their arthritis, they couldn't roll properly and they couldn't get the hang of like this mat that they'd bought. So I rolled it for them. But it's those sorts of discussions and those sorts of spaces that just get totally overlooked, don't they? We sort of like tend to focus on certain types of drugs. There's a drug hierarchy even within research.
There is. I mean, there's a drug hierarchy even within research, but also it depends on what the research is for. If it's like, are you looking at problematic drug use, then you'll be looking at heroin and crack cocaine in the context of the UK, maybe others in other countries. Or are you looking at recreational drug use? Then it's like MDMA. You know what I mean? It's like it's very sort of one note.
Exactly. So, you know, we'll start to wind down now. But who was this like research for? What was the purpose of this research? Who were you trying to reach with this?
I think, like in the first instance, I'd say it's for people whose experiences are similar to the ones that participants are talking about, who may feel as a result that their experiences are legitimated, or indeed that they feel like they can relate. You know, I like the idea of, well, initially when we made the film before COVID, we thought we were going to screen it, you know, around the country, and that we'd have debates in like lecture rooms or like small cinemas or whatever. So we thought, you know, it would be nice to get a mixed audience of like, you know, people who have those same experiences and therefore can relate, but also people whose experiences are very different and therefore they're curious and they want to understand more. You know, we had such people in a couple of screenings that we did, you know, people who were really into dance floors but not into drugs, people who are into drugs but not into dance floors. But also I don't know, the most touching thing for me was somebody who I knew through, like, basically my mate's mom came with her son. Her son is really into dance floors and takes drugs. She doesn't at all. And they, you know, used to get into like massive rows and arguments about it. They used to kind of not really kind of talk about it, or like he would hold back from being honest. She would get upset about his, ways and stuff like that. And, you know, they wouldn't have an honest discussion about it. They wouldn't be able to. And apparently after they came to watch the film, they did. They were able to like just have this, like, for the first time, they were able to kind of have an open discussion. She was like, I think I have a better understanding about my son. And and that to me was really powerful. And I thought, you know, maybe there is something in this film or maybe in things like this to be able to kind of enable that kind of honest discussion between parents and their children. Or
And we'll, you know, for people listening, we'll put a link in the blog that's attached to this so that you can go and look at the film. And if you want to reach out to Julia, I'm sure she'll be pleased to hear from you. So for people that are listening, can you tell us what the name of the film was? And can you also tell us the name of the article, the journal, the article that came off the back of this?
Yeah, sure. So the film is called People and Dance Floors, Narratives of Drug Taking. And we have a website, www.peopleanddancefloors.com. Hopefully easy enough to remember. So everything that we've done, the film itself, the trailers for the film and the sort of teasers, if you're not sure whether you want to watch the film, but you want to sort of take a quick look, are there as well. We have a podcast series, a few kind of bits of blogging and a few articles as well, which kind of detail a bit more about just our motivation for the project and the sort of different people involved. And then the article, there is an academic article that came out, which is a kind of, I guess, autoethnographic, you could say, at least in part, and it's called We, Ourselves and Us. Hopefully that'll be enough. It's in the International Journal of Drug Policy. Yes. Part of a special issue, actually, on research and activism in drug policy. So I think lots of the articles in that special issue will be interesting for people who are interested in drugs and drug policy.
So what have you got in the pipeline at the moment? What are you working on currently?
I'm working on a book proposal, Rachel. I've gone mad. We'll see. But I'm gonna try to write a book. See if I've got enough oomph in me to do that. The Malta project came out of just an idea, basically. Well, actually, somebody from Malta got really excited about the People and Dance Floors project and was like, "This is amazing! I want to be involved." And I was like, "Great, let's do something together." So essentially I'm open for anybody who wants to do something that is, you know, under that umbrella. As I said, I have, been recently in contact with PhD students and people at sort of different points in their kind of early career research who, are wanting to collaborate in different ways, using the blog as a platform, or like maybe doing different bits of film and make a contribution. Somebody who's a poet made a contribution talking about their last experience of dancing before COVID happened and kind of reminiscing about that. So yeah, just, I don't know, like open platform and happy to have more discussions with people and also to be called out and criticized by people about things that I should have done or things that we could still do with it, with the project.
So my name is Rachel Stewart. I'm a PhD researcher at the University of Kent. And I've been talking to, like most entertainingly, to Julia Zampini, who's a criminology lecturer at the University of Greenwich in London. And thank you so much.
Thanks, Rachel. Thanks, everyone.